Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for July 6th, 2009, and on this week's episode, Ann Nicholson Weber interviews Henry Godinez from Teatro Vista. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready, and let's talk theater.
This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast. I'm your host, Ann Nicholson Weber, and my guest today is Henry Godinez, who is the resident artistic associate at Goodman. He also teaches at Northwestern, where he's an associate professor, and he is one of the co-founding directors of Teatro Vista. So welcome, Henry.
Thank you.
I got Good that morning. Introduction out.
Perfect. It's a challenge.
As it turns out, it was. I want to talk to you today about, first of all, the lovely production of Boleros for the Disenchanted by Jose Rivera, which is playing now at Goodman Theater. And then maybe more broadly about what you called before our interview culturally centered theater, which I think is a very interesting and topical conversation raised, for instance, by the controversy in New York about the August Wilson production on Broadway being directed by someone who isn't Black. So let's start, though, with something very particular and concrete and in our own backyard, which is this this beautiful play by Jose Rivera. Maybe you can talk, first of all, about the process. I know that you directed the world premiere at Yale Rep. So when did you come into it? When did you get introduced to this play?
Well, I had listened to a reading that was done at the Goodman about 3 years ago of the piece while it was still in development. And my cohorts at Teatro Vista did a reading for Jose, who happened to be in town.
And how did he connect with Chicago?
We have a history with Jose. I directed a play of his called Cloud Tectonics at the old Goodman Studio back in 95. Then off and on throughout the years, we've been connected.
Now, he is probably known best in the bigger culture because he wrote Motorcycle Diaries.
Correct, yeah.
And when did that happen? That was his first movie, right?
I don't know that it was his first movie. I think he'd written another movie before that, and he'd written for television. But it was definitely, it was a big thing for him to be nominated for an Academy Award. But he's been really one of the great American playwrights since the early 80s, and definitely one of the big, big players in Latino theater since the early 80s. So he has quite a following, actually, even outside the Latino theater scene, because his writing is so kind of traditionally, it's very magical realism feeling, you know. Mm-hmm. Which is what's so interesting about Boleros, because it's not so much.
Why don't you first quickly describe what the play is?
Well, Boleros for the Disenchanted is very autobiographical for Jose. It's based on the life of his mother and his father, but specifically focusing on his mother, I think. We start Boleros for the Disenchanted in 1953 in Puerto Rico when his parents meet and they fall in love and eventually get married, and then, like so many other people at that time in Puerto Rico, decided, you know, for a future, they had to move to the United States. And then the beginning of Act Two, we are already, we start Act Two in Daleville, Alabama, in 1993. And what I did, because we wanted to use a turntable, was a purely just shameless technical suggestion by the technical director, Brian, who... We were trying to figure out how we could, at intermission, with just the limited amount of crew that we had, how could we change it over?
Right.
And he said, I think it'd just be easier on a turntable. And I literally went, wow, bing, you know.
That's it.
Because at Yale, I always felt like it was two different plays. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like the audience would come back after intermission, and it took them a couple of minutes to go, wait a minute.
How does this relate to what we just saw?
And is this older Flora, the younger Flora? And so when the idea of the turntable came up, I was like, what if we took the beginning of Act Two tack it on to the end of Act One using the turntable mm-hmm. to revolve and reveal, you know, them 39 years later, and then go to intermission. Mm-hmm. And then so that there would be a moment where we had the two couples juxtaposed visually on the set.
And now we know A equals A and B equals B.
Hopefully, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. and yet subtly enough that it wouldn't be like beating us over the head with it. So I asked Jose if I could do that, and he said, sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, the effect of that, it's kind of a coup de théâtre. It's very, because the set is completely static and very elaborate. Mm-hmm. The first act set is one of those sets we walk in and we say, well, we're going to stay here
because they can't. Because it's so big.
Right, you can't move
this.
Oh,
that's cool. That's good to know.
And so then suddenly it does move, it changes, and the whole, the incredible contrast between their two worlds of Puerto Rico and the, you know, rural and primitive and flowers, and then this rather, what's the word, when you're stuck in one place, claustrophobic and urban and, I mean, not urban, but, you know,
it's very stark
apartment, and, yeah, mm-hmm. it's not related to nature. We see that juxtaposition in a way that you wouldn't if you had the intermission between. So I think that's very effective.
Oh, cool.
And plus it, of course, creates that element of suspense. Like, obviously, things have gone differently than one might have imagined. It has kind of a almost a happily ever after feeling there at the end of Act One. The lovers get together and go off hand in hand.
Yeah.
And so that sense of there's more to this mm-hmm. is made very
Oh, that was my hope.
Purposeful.
That's cool. That was definitely my hope. And it's a big gesture because it's a big set. And it, as you said, it's a big turntable. And it takes almost a minute to
revolve. Turn the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And luckily we have this gorgeous music by Gustavo Leone that was composed for the show that helps fill that with a lot of emotion.
Well, now let's talk about the issue of what you called culturally centered theater. Obviously, as a co-founder of Teatro Vista, this is something that must be important to you. So why don't you talk first about what was the impulse there? What was your reason for founding that company?
Well, Eddie Torres, my buddy Eddie, and I started the company with a group of actors in 1990-91. And it's because Eddie and I were in a play at the Goodman called The Rover, which is a swashbuckler kind of play. And there was another Latino actor in that production named Ramiro Carrillo, God rest his soul, who's just a fabulous man and great actor. And, you know, at one point Eddie looked around and said, my goodness, there are three Latino actors in this play. And, you know, this is 1989.
Yeah.
And two of them are playing principal characters. Eddie was right out of school. He was playing an ensemble member. Mm. So he was really taken by that. And he was an intern at Remains and was Remains Theater and was reading, you know, one of his jobs was reading all these scripts that would come through and all these great Latino plays, Jose's mm-hmm. plays, Octavio Solis, Nilo Cruz. But Remains would never do them because mm-hmm. Remains was primarily a terrific white company. I mean, great people like, you know, Gary Cole and Amy Morton. So Eddie said, why don't we start a company? Mm-hmm. And I was young enough and stupid enough that I said, sure.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Let's wreck our lives.
Why not? You know, we're not married. We don't have kids.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Because no one was producing these plays, and they're just beautiful plays.
Well, that's interesting. So the writing was there.
Was the impetus.
Already.
Yeah, the writing was there. But theaters weren't producing them. Theaters weren't producing, especially major theaters, these plays because they didn't think there was an audience for them. Mm-hmm. So our idea at Teatro Vista was we will produce these plays, we will develop an audience, we will develop artists so that eventually, you know, these larger theaters will realize that there is an audience, that there are actors, there are directors, there are designers, there are plays, mm-hmm. and therefore do them. Because we weren't interested in just, you know, staying in one little area and say, and just doing them for the community in the community. We mm-hmm. believed from the beginning that Latino theater needed to be part of the mainstream theatrical movement, just because we as actors wanted to work in the mainstream mm-hmm. and we wanted our culture to be represented in the mainstream. And we believed that that was the future. you know.
Is theater a sort of an indigenous part of Latino culture?
I think it is. I think it is. You know, definitely in Latin America, there's a wonderful, strong tradition of all kinds of theater, street theater, popular theater. The same is true in Spain, and it came to the Americas, you know, with the Spaniards. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were playhouses in South America within years of settlements being established. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always for hundreds of years. The thing is that so many people of Spanish heritage, of Latino heritage, that have come to this country came for a variety of reasons, either economic or political. And so theater wasn't the first thing on the agenda. Survival was, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Earning a living, taking care of your family, establishing yourself. And so theater has been, you know, had been kind of put to the back of the burner, you know, the back burner.
Well, I'll push you a little on that because I'm thinking about the example of the Yiddish theater mm-hmm. Among the immigrants in New York right. at the turn of the century. I mean, clearly there are, and this actually is the reason I'm pushing on this, because it's very important to me in the whole issue of what I have called in my head identity-based theater, what you're calling mm-hmm. culturally-based theater. So that contrast between the Yiddish theater and what you're saying about how theater here never really took hold within the Latino communities does suggest a different weight mm-hmm. from the cultures of origin.
Right.
And maybe, you know, ignorantly, but I think of music as being absolutely central
absolutely.
To Latino culture.
Definitely.
And then maybe not theater. So that's right. what I wanted to kind of sort through.
No, I think that's music is definitely, I mean, if you had to, you know, prioritize them, I think there's mm-hmm. no question that music would come first. It's like the air that, you know, people breathe.
Right.
It's just part of the fabric. You know, there is in the Mexican-American communities of California, for instance, and in the Southwest, there are long traditions of a very specific kind of popular theater, actos and corridos and combinations of theater and music. You know, it's mm-hmm. very kind of... it's like a living newspaper sort of thing, you know. But in specifically in Chicago, it just never took, you know, root the way uh-huh. it did in California and in the Southwest.
Uh-huh.
When we started Teatro Vista, there was a Latino theater. There was a company called Latino Chicago that was doing some wonderful theater, very specific and particular. And not necessarily the kind of theater that Eddie and I were interested in. They mm-hmm. they were not as interested at all in collaborating with mainstream theaters. They didn't believe that, you know, I mean, they wanted to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so did we, but we also felt like, you know what, we belong downtown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Latino, mm-hmm. the Latino community deserves to be represented at the highest levels of, you know, the cultural life of the city.
Mm-hmm. So was that, what was the name of the other theater?
Latino Chicago.
Latino Chicago. Was that more of a kind of community political?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you could say
community center theater,
right,
I think of that.
Right. Very political, very uh-huh. political. And, you know, didn't always look favorably on some of the collaborations that we were interested in doing.
Because you were somehow selling out.
Of course.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And there are still... you know, elements of the community, and I suspect any community that see, you know, the sort of work that we're doing, that I'm doing, as, you know, selling out to the big white mainstream institution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my feeling on that is whatever, you know, people say whatever, and, you know, you can either let it hold you back or not. But my feeling is that's not the future, you know, and that we need and must have, you know, arts in the community, but we also deserve to be represented at the Art Institute, at the Symphony, at the Goodman, at the Museum of Contemporary Art, whatever, you know.
Well, the assumption of someone criticizing you for, quote, selling out to the white establishment is that you are first and foremost a Latino and second an artist. I mean, any
right.
artist wants to do his art at the highest level possible.
Right.
Now, what is high level, right? That's part of the question,
that's
I suppose.
That's right.
But if you were a classically trained actor, if you want to do that kind of theater,
Right.
This is where it happens, right?
Absolutely. And I was an apprentice for a year in between undergraduate school and graduate school at the Actors Theater of Louisville in the early 80s, which is a great theater. And back then it was one of the greatest theaters in the country with the new play festival. And so for a year I worked as a slave, basically, in this great theater. And I said, this is the kind of theater I want to do.
Yeah.
Because it was at its highest artistic level in every way. And that's just the kind of theater I'm interested in doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And for many years at the beginning of Teatro Vista, we did it with nothing. We built all our own sets and props and, you know, in the smallest spaces. And it was about the work. And that was fantastic, too. Mm-hmm. And there was great value in that. And the work, I thought, was beautiful. So it isn't just the money that you throw at it. It's what you put into it, you know, as an artist.
Well, it sounds like you must have started kind of right at the time when, or maybe into the wave of interest on the part of foundations, mm-hmm. in broadening audiences, that whole project of widening the...
Yeah.
And so that would have helped, I imagine.
It did help. And I was very blessed to have had a nice acting career. I was working a lot with Barbara Gaines in those days, in the early days of what is now Chicago Shakespeare.
Right.
It used to be Shakespeare Rep. And at the Goodman. And so I was able to leverage some of that visibility with some foundation folks and folks in the community that helped us with a little funding. The MacArthur Foundation was an early supporter of ours, Joyce Foundation. And then, interestingly, I read the way we connected with the Goodman in 94 was that I saw that they had gotten $1 million grant from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund to diversify their audiences, which mm-hmm. they had been doing with August Wilson beautifully. Mm-hmm. So I went to Rock Schulfer, the executive director, and I said, hey, this is great. What are you going to do with that money? What about Latino audiences?
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, what do you want to do? Mm-hmm. So, but definitely foundations were just really starting to realize, hey, you know, we got to include the entire community of Chicago here.
I mean, I guess one question is, why couldn't the Goodman just be a white theater and right. Teatro Vista be the Latino theater? Why? I mean, I think I know the answer, because somehow there's a cultural prestige to an institution like the Goodman, and that underlies this assumption that therefore we want to have it for everyone.
Right. Well, I think part of it is that the Goodman sees itself as the city's theater, flagship theater.
You uh-huh.
know, we get a lot of public funding. We're in the middle of downtown. And we should represent all of the city, not
mm-hmm.
just the white city,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, even if they are the majority. I just think that we as a nation have historically always been a nation of immigrants and then a melting pot. And I just think it's foolish for us to continue to segregate our art. You know?
Well, I guess every artist makes the choice about how important their antecedent is to who they are artistically. Mm-hmm. And for someone like Jose Rivera, it seems this is what he writes about to a big degree.
Right.
But obviously you can be a Latino artist for whom that's not your main. You might be interested in something completely different.
That's
about,
right. That's right. And I know some wonderful Latino artists that are not interested in Latino, you know, themed
uh-huh.
work at all.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
You know, Raul Esparza, you know, is also, I think he was born here, but he's of Cuban heritage. You know, he's like the big guy in New York on Broadway, mm-hmm. you know. Not that he's not interested, it's just as an artist, that's...
Is that where his art comes out
right,
of?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Well, all this is making me think about the... there's kind of a controversy about the Joe Turner's Come and Gone production on Broadway because it was directed by a white guy,
mm-hmm.
Bartlett Sher. And... I've heard that there are even members of the cast who objected on principle to the idea that a white guy should have the opportunity to do this play of this quintessentially African-American, both the writer himself and the content and themes. So I'm interested in your take on that.
Well, it is interesting, especially given, you know, several years back when August Wilson was still alive and, you know, the whole kind of debate between him and, was it Robert?
Brustein.
Brustein, yeah. You know, and I think that August was always committed to having African-American directors and, you know, that do his work. I don't know how it came about that Bart was chosen as the director, other than the fact that he's had, you know, a lot of success in New York recently with South Pacific. He's very successful.
He's a hot ticket right now.
He is, and he runs the Intiman Theater in Seattle. Yeah. He's a great guy and a really thoughtful human being, a very conscientious human being. So I personally don't, you know, because I know him, I don't feel like he's the kind of guy that swooped in to take advantage of the situation or that would be insensitive to the material. Mm-hmm. It is tricky, though. I would hope that they exhausted every other possibility, that they really did consider people like Kenny Leon, Derek Sanders, who's from Chicago here, from Congo Square, who's kind of emerging on a national level. Ron O.J. Parsons is another Chicago director who's really emerging. Ralph Bellamy. I mean, there are others, you know. And because there are African-American directors like that that have been fighting the good fight, I can understand why there would be some discontent. Mm-hmm. And certainly I feel it, even though I like Bart as a human being, that when those high-profile opportunities come around, which are rare compared to non-ethnically specific plays,
right,
that they would go with a non-African-American director. I can certainly understand the upset there.
And is it, in your view, and obviously you don't know what the people who are fighting about this would say, but is it almost, I guess you could say, an affirmative action idea that there are so few opportunities for African-American or, well, in this case, African-American directors to do a Broadway show? Or is it an artistic issue about whether a white guy can really understand this material?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I do think that there are probably some African-American directors that could do a wonderful job with that play. Do they have the name that Bart has right now? Probably not, you know, in terms of a draw for a New York audience. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a lot to say for the fact that, I mean, I think that an African-American director would bring a nuance to a production like that that maybe a white director can't, you know, from their own personal experience. And I say that hoping and thinking that when I direct a play like Boleros or Anna in the Tropics, that, for instance, I think I've had an affinity with Anna in the Tropics being a Cuban-themed play and my being Cuban that maybe Emily Mann didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, a sensibility that Emily, as being as great a director as she is and an amazing theater artist, didn't have something available to her that I do. You know.
But then you would have to live with the flip side of that, which is to say that for, I don't know, a play like August, Osage County or something, right, you should have a white guy who might have... But that's not
right.
True in
but
the
it
theater.
Isn't true. I mean, that isn't true. And that's why I don't... That's why I'm very cautious about making hard and fast statements.
Yeah,
you know,
because
I do think that what if I was the perfect director to direct August, Osage County? Hey, Anna Shapiro, who's a great friend... she's a young Jewish woman from
right.
Chicago.
She got to do
what
with...
does she have to do with, like, white trash kind of, you know, old money people
in
from Oklahoma?
Right, exactly.
You
I
know?
Mean, the whole enterprise of theater is to imagine ourselves into other people's
That's
skins.
Right. That's right. So it's a tricky thing, that, you know? It's a really tricky thing. As an artist, I don't get militant about someone like Bart directing Joe Turner, because I think he's a wonderful, wonderful director, and no doubt did August Wilson proud, you know, and was able to lead those actors into terrific performances. And yet, you know, I long for the day when there are 5 African-American plays on Broadway, and then 4 of the 5 directors are African-American.
Right.
That would be wonderful.
Or the African-American directors are directing South Oklahoma.
Pacific.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Or Shrek the Musical.
Or Tom Stoppard.
Or Tom Stoppard. Right. You know, yeah. But as an actor, I went and trained my ass off at the strongest classical theater training program I could find because I loved Shakespeare. I wanted to do Shakespeare, and I didn't want someone to say, well, you know, Shakespeare's only for Anglo actors.
Right,
you know?
Right. Which clearly, I mean, it's so interesting that classical theater, which is kind of at the core of what you might call the Eurocentric culture, has become the entree for, I mean, the most colorblind casting. Nobody thinks twice anymore in a classical play about casting anybody, I'd say.
As long as they're able to, you know, have the skills
can
to deal
it.
With the language.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. And I don't think there's anyone that comes to see Boleros that leaves thinking, oh, I can't relate to that.
No. I mean, that would be like saying, I can't relate to Shakespeare because it was written in Elizabethan times.
Right.
Or something. I mean, it's silly to say.
It is silly.
If it's great, it will move us. Mm-hmm. Well, and a last word about Boleros. It's because it does somehow touch something bigger than itself, whatever that quality is. And we were talking before the interview, I was trying to characterize the style. There's almost a folktale directness about it that actually I wouldn't have thought would work on stage, but absolutely does. Becomes poetic. It's very hard to describe, but what seems like a very kind of literal story about two very earthbound people somehow takes on a resonance that's bigger than that.
Well, you know, Jose is just a great writer. He's just a great writer, period. Mm-hmm. And he acknowledges that that sometimes it borders on being cheesy. And I acknowledge that sometimes I border on being a cheesy director in terms of, just, you know, shameless.
Pull out the hanky.
Yeah.
If I can make you pull out the hanky, I will.
That's right. I feel great about that.
So you're an artist of the heart.
I think I am.
Uh-huh.
For better or worse.
I mean, Tom Stoppard is probably not.
No.
And he can write wonderful and actually very moving plays in a different way. But
exactly.
There are lots of ways in, I think.
I think there are.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Anne. Thank you for having me.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Mote, bringing you the theater news for the week of July 6th, 2009. TheaterInChicago.com is pleased and excited to announce the launch of our new auditions page. That's right, a comprehensive listing of the equity and non-equity theater and film auditions here in the Chicagoland area. After a number of requests, we are making this feature available. We are adding it to our database of current upcoming shows, news, reviews, podcasts, and oh, so much more, making TheaterInChicago.com a true one-stop site for everything Chicago theater-related. The audition listings are continuously updated throughout the day. They're easy to read, and they include all the details an actor needs to know, such as audition material, time commitment, character breakdown, locations, and contact information. Since the auditions page is a brand new feature, it is still in the beta process, so improvements are constantly being made to the site. In addition to the auditions and jobs postings, a resources page will be coming down in the future. This page is meant to help actors find headshot photographers, classes, coaches, and all the other networking tools they need to succeed. If you have any suggestions for improving the auditions page, you can email them to us at auditions@theaterinchicago.com. Listen for it, auditions@theaterinchicago.com. And also, if you're a theater company who wants to have an audition of yours posted on the site, you can contact us at the same address. The link to the auditions page can be found on the main theaterinchicago.com homepage. It's on the left sidebar all the way down. And if you click on it, No sign-up is necessary. You can get right into the auditions. So this is a hot new feature, and it's going to be big for us. So check it out as soon as you can, and check it out often. The Second City is opening a new show that will be in honor of the late Studs Terkel. It'll be opening on July 19th. Studs Terkel's Not Working can be seen at Piper's Alley. It'll include Christina Anthony, Amanda Blake Davis, and Tom Flanagan, amongst other Second City members. The show will be, of course, heavily focused on Chicago, and I'm betting it's going to be a good time. For more information on Studs Terkel's Not Working, click on over to our Coming Soon section. Benno Nelson brings us yet another article in his Full Store Frontal series. This time he interviews Mikkel Marr, a co-founder of Theater Ublik, a company that was founded over 20 years ago and was named for a type of weather created for a demanding monarch in Dr. Seuss's Bartholomew and the Ublik. For more information about Theater Ublik and some more stories, check out Benno Nelson's latest article at theaterinchicago.com. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Henry Godinez for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.